This is Cited, the only podcast with a bibliography. My name is Sam Fan.
And I'm Gordon Caddick. Cited is about how the ideas of the Ivory Tower shape our world, sometimes in troubling ways.
It's 1975. Three criminologists, Douglas Lipton, Judith Wilkes, and Robert Martinson, publish a 700-page book. It's called The Effectiveness of Correctional Treatment.
Their book has one big question. Has anyone figured out a way to take criminals and turn them into law-abiding citizens?
They came to the conclusion that nothing worked.
This is Catherine Beckett, one of the producers of today's show and a sociologist at the University of Washington. Catherine tells us that the authors didn't find anything that consistently worked.
This idea that rehabilitative programs were not and could not be effective became kind of the basis for a lot of criminal justice policies that were adopted in the 1970s and 80s.
In 1975, the criminal justice system is all about discretion. Parole boards can let you out if you seem rehabilitated, or they can make you languish behind bars if you don't seem rehabilitated. Reformers complain that these decisions seem arbitrary, and in the worst cases, pretty racist.
And then this book comes out, and it says we can't rehabilitate people anyway. So they think, okay, well, if we can't fix criminals, let's at least be fair to them. Politicians can decide what the penalties are, and they can write clear sentencing standards for everybody. But there's just one problem. Those three criminologists were wrong. On today's show, the story of one man and how their bad idea radically transformed his life.
When I recount the story to people, they're horrified because I'm just Joe Average.
This is David Grenier, a businessman from Tacoma, Washington, which is a suburb of Seattle. And it's 1994, the year with the highest rate of juvenile violent crime on record.
It was just a normal day, normal sunny day, coming back from lunch thinking I was going to be late for a 2:30 meeting.
David parks his car. Three teenagers walk up. One of them is 14 years old. His name is Jeff Coates. He's with two friends, Anthony and Gene.
They looked young and not scary. Coates had a name badge on, I think, for goodness sake. And they kept.
Yes, Jeff is actually wearing a uniform with his name stitched into it. Him and the other boys corner David and they force him to get in the car and start driving.
They kept trying to pretend they had code names, but then they'd use their real names and they'd say, why did you just use my real name? And dumb things like that.
They tell David they've got a shotgun in their backpack and they force David to drive over to the bank and empty his account. Then they stop off at a store and buy duct tape.
I kept trying to reason with them saying, you know, you really should take my car and take my money and leave me behind because it's a whole different crime to steal a person's money or a car as to steal the person, you know? So,
and then we were like trying to figure out, well, what do we do? We're in Tacoma.
That voice you're hearing is Jeff Coates. And here's his plan. He's going to drive David far out into a secluded area and leave him there without a phone. It could take David hours to reach someone. And by that time, Jeff, Gene, and Anthony will be long gone.
And so one of my friends said, well, we could take him to the Puyallup River. So we have him drive us. And we get there and everybody's fishing on the Puyallup River. So I'm like, this is not secluded. Like, what are we going to, like, plus he watched us drive here. So he knows exactly where he is. He knows exactly how to get away and knows exactly how to go tell on us. So we need to put him in the trunk of his car.
So the guys drive the car down a deserted dirt road and they tell David, get out.
And then if we put him in the trunk of the car, he's going to be banging. So we need to make sure he can't bang on the trunk of the car. We don't want him driving down the street and this guy's banging on the trunk.
And so they bound my hands and my feet, three circles of duct tape. They put me in the trunk and I had tape over my eyes and tape over my mouth.
David is trying to stay calm, even as he's lying in the trunk. But then he feels a fresh piece of duct tape pulled across his nose.
And I was just shocked by it. It just like all came crashing in at the same moment. I can't even describe the emotions when you actually realize that somebody is trying to kill you. I reacted just with an intense adrenaline rush, I think, and I busted the tape off, ripped it off my face, and said, you know, yelled or something, and they slammed the trunk down.
Jeff claims this is all a big mistake. He says he was sitting in the front seat while Gene and Anthony were taping up David, and they meant to tape up his mouth, but a little bit of it got over the top of his nose. Then David freaked out, and so did Gene and Anthony. They slammed the trunk closed and ran back into the car.
Either way, it didn't feel like an accident to David.
And so he's banging, and we're like, well, we got to go back there and tell him to calm down. We don't have a weapon. And so we're like looking around. There's a pair of channel locks on the floorboard of this guy's car.
I heard him outside, hit him with this. And I remember thinking, if only I could be like the amazing Kreskin who used to bend spoons with his mind. And I thought, if I could get that trunk to pop open.
So I'm thinking that the guy's taped up. I'll just pop the trunk with these keys real quick.
I had broken my hands free. I prepared myself in the trunk to fight.
We're all like exiting the car. As soon as I push the button, the trunk pops up, the guy jumps out and he starts taking off and he's running down the street, and I'm in sandals and I'm like chasing him, and then realize that what am I going to do if I caught this guy? And then I see him jump on this garbage truck.
I jumped on the side where the workers go, because there are handles on the side. Then the person finally stopped, and I was like, you have got to help. You have got to. They're trying to kill me. I had been working so hard to get free that when he finally said, okay, I'll come in the cab, I couldn't let go.
You couldn't let go of the truck.
Yeah. It was weird. It was like, you know, you're safe. Yeah. So I used to tell that story as a fun thing. Now I'm all choking up for some reason.
The guys drive back to the group home, and the cops are already there. They split everybody up and interrogate them one by one.
Turns out that Jeff wanted a car for his first day of high school. So the boys decided to kidnap someone and force them to sign over the title to the car. By the way, no, that's not how it works.
Then the cops do that classic thing you see in movies. They offer a deal to the first guy who will flip on the others.
Gene flips. He tells them the entire plan. And one disturbing detail comes out. This wasn't just a kidnapping. They had also talked about giving someone a Colombian necktie. If you're squeamish, skip forward a few seconds. Okay, you've been warned. A Colombian necktie is when you slit someone's throat and pull their tongue out through the opening.
Jeff says this was never the plan. He says an older guy named Will did bring up Colombian neckties, but Jeff and the others were shocked by this, so they left Will behind.
But this still looks bad. They did have a plan in the day planner. They did take knives. They did drive David out to a secluded area. They did put duct tape over his mouth, eyes, and nose. And David did hear someone say, hit him with this.
I got charged with a lot of charges. Attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, robbery, conspiracy to commit robbery, kidnapping, conspiracy to commit kidnapping.
Jeff is only 14 years old, but the prosecution wants to try him as an adult anyway. In order to do that, they're going to have to go through a hearing and convince a judge.
If Jeff is convicted as a juvenile, he'll likely get around 2.5 years in juvie. If he's convicted as an adult, the max sentence is life without parole.
The public defender gets a psychologist named Herbert Mara. He has him spend 6 hours evaluating Jeff. Mara's trying to figure out what made Jeff do this crime.
Jeff is a pleasant-appearing Caucasian 14-year-old. He has a friendly smile.
By the way, this isn't Herbert Mara. This is one of my history professors, and he's reading from Mara's forensic evaluation.
And he appears to be both trying to be honest, as well as placing himself in a very favorable light.
Jeff tells Mara about his childhood. He grew up extremely poor. His family lived in a trailer. It didn't get any heat, electricity, or water.
His mother, Terry, is married to Harry, age 42, a Vietnam vet. Jeff said that when he lived at the home of his parents, he was abused. The abuse came primarily from his stepfather, an extremely harsh and unpredictable disciplinarian.
Jeff tells Mara that Harry beat him. That's why he was put into foster care. And when he was in the foster care system, he bounced around a lot. One social worker told him that he went to 62 different homes.
In some ways, the system failed to identify and intervene on Jeff's behalf during his early developmental years. Jeff has been living a day-to-day existence for most of his short life, and his needs are more for habilitation than for rehabilitation.
If Jeff gets what he needs, habilitation, in other words, training and treatment that can give him stability, if he gets that, could Jeff turn things around? Mara thinks yes. He writes, Jeff is a 14-year-old victim whose troubles could have been predicted 10 years ago. He underlines the word victim.
At 14 years of age, there is adequate time to deal with Jeff's problem and prevent a continuing cycle of being a failed victim of the system. There is strong support for Jeff to receive interventions and services within the Department of Juvenile Rehabilitation.
The guards walk Jeff over to his hearing. His family's not here. There's only a prosecutor, a lawyer, some court staff, and Judge Thomas R. Soriel. Soriel will decide whether Jeff will stay in the juvenile system or be transferred into the adult system. Remember, the difference could be between 2 years or life in prison.
Do you remember the time? Did you feel confident that they were going to try you as a minor?
You know, these questions are hard to answer because you're a kid, you know. You're not thinking. You're like, when's rec? Rec's at 7. Oh, I get to play basketball at 7.
You might think that judges would be lenient with a 14-year-old, but not in 1994. That's the year when politicians are actually saying things like, we've got to get tough on juvenile crime.
Because juvenile crime rates are as high as they've ever been. And a political scientist named John DeLillo Jr. is predicting that the rates will spike even further. He calls these juveniles super predators, a new breed of offender with no respect for human life.
We're talking about a group of kids who are growing up essentially fatherless, godless, and jobless.
By the year 2005, we may very well have a bloodbath of teenage violence.
That's the kind of panic that surrounds this courtroom. In 1994, U.S. judges transfer over 13,000 juveniles into the adult system. That's the most ever.
Judge Soriel agrees with the prosecution. Jeff is not rehabilitatable. So the only thing the state can do is keep him away from the public. And just like that, Washington sends a 14-year-old to be tried as an adult.
Jeff is led out of the courtroom by two officers, one on each side, and they walk him down a long white corridor. Jeff thinks to himself, this is the road from childhood to adulthood.
I am beyond rage. I'm horrified that these teenagers could conspire to commit murder as if it were just another task in a day planner.
That's David Grenier again, and he's reading a letter that he sent to Jeff's sentencing judge.
Where is the conscience? Where is the morality? In a perfect world, your job would be to bestow upon these individuals the traits they lack so that they would never again be capable of such acts. In the real world, however, you can only order the most severe and maximum sentences allowable by law. Even then, I don't believe these sentences would be commensurate with their crimes and the impact that these crimes have had on their completely innocent victims.
Gene gets 10 years because he turned state's witness. Anthony gets 30 because he pled innocent but was found guilty. Jeff pleads guilty to all of his charges but the conspiracy to commit murder. For that, he takes an Alford plea. That's where you maintain your innocence but admit that the case against you is too strong. It's a deal. Jeff gets 20 years.
And then they ask you these questions in the hearing. So do you understand what you're losing? I wish I could go back in time as an adult and be like, are you fucking kidding me? My lawyer just told me to answer yes to that question. Yes, Your Honor. To rebel against the sentence, everybody thought it would be cool if we took a Sharpie marker and just wrote all over the walls. So we wrote the 20 all big and
with this Sharpie marker and was laughing about it and joking around, and they gave me 20 years. I don't give a fuck.
After the break, a 14-year-old goes to adult prison. You're listening to Cited, a program about how the ideas of the ivory tower shape our world, sometimes in disturbing ways. I'm Sam Finn.
And I'm Gordon Caddick. Back in 1 minute. Cited used to be called the Terry Project on CITR. That program ran for 57 episodes. When we finally figured out what we really wanted to do, we became Cited. But along the way, the Terry Project told some amazing stories. Like our 15th episode, when Abdu returned to Libya and defended a school from terrorists.
We'll have some guns, we'll have a couple guys up there, and we'll have, when they come, we'll just have someone negotiate with them, and if they don't want to, then let them into the school. Let them all get in into the school and get into the cemetery, where they'll all be kind of like trapped inside. And then he's just like, and then just riddle them with bullets.
You can find that episode and the entire Terry Project archive at citedpodcast.com. Now, back to Cited.
Welcome back to Cited. I'm Sam Fenn.
And I'm Gordon Caddick.
Before the break, Jeff Coates was sentenced to 20 years.
They escorted me off the bus and they walked me right to a...
When he gets to prison, he's the only 14-year-old there. And kids are way more likely to be abused, so the guards don't know what to do with him. They put him in solitary confinement, and Jeff is locked up alone for 23 hours a day, and he wants out.
I have 20 years. Are you going to keep me in segregation until I'm 18 for the next 4 or 5 years? I mean, it's going to happen eventually at some point. Why not start now?
Jeff spends 90 days in solitary confinement. The next day, he's walking around the track out in the yard. It's early in the morning, and a fat white guy calls Jeff over.
The guy, Tom, he's like, yeah, my name's Big Tom, for obvious reasons. Yeah, he's like 6'5", 300 pound, big guy, doing pull-ups. I'm like, not that. I'm like 140 or something. And he finally just said, do you have any questions? I'm like, do people die here? He's like, yeah. I'm like, do people get stabbed here? He's like, yeah. I'm like, do people get raped here? He's like, listen, you just got to follow the 3 F's and you'll be fine. He's like, fight, fuck, or hit the fence. If someone's going to disrespect you, you have 3 options. You're either going to fight them, you're going to let them fuck you, or you're going to hit the fence. You're going to try to escape. So when that time comes, you'll know it. And you will make your choice. And when you make that choice is what's going to follow you for the rest of your prison sentence.
Just a few days later, a 35-year-old sex offender calls Jeff a punk. In prison, a punk is basically anyone who you can rape.
He disrespected me. So that was my moment of, what are you going to do? Fight, fuck, or hit the fence?
Jeff decides to fight, but this guy is a lot bigger than him. So Jeff kicks him down the stairs, and the guy's hurt, but he gets back up, and he starts throwing punches.
And I'm fighting this guy, and he's kind of covering up, and I'm trying to punch him in the face as much as I can, but he's walking, like, towards me, and I'm backing up.
There's a 5-gallon bucket of water against the wall. Jeff doesn't see it.
And I wind up knocking over that 5-gallon bucket, and the water goes everywhere, and then I slip in it. And then I hit my head on the concrete wall, and then I hit my head on the ground as I went down, and I knocked out. And had a seizure. While I'm having the seizure, he jumps on top of me and hits me in the face 5 times. But that fight gave me 2 black eyes for 2 years. That when I was in the hospital, I wanted to look in the mirror and I could see clearly, but when you look at my face, my eyes were like very thin slits.
Word spreads around the prison. A 15-year-old started a fight with a 35-year-old sex offender. This earns Jeff a reputation. You can't take advantage of him because he'll fight you. And the strategy works, although it's a painful one. Jeff gets into about 15 more fights and he loses all of them. But he never gets raped.
In 2002, 6 years into his sentence, Jeff gets a call on the phone. It's his mom. This is the first time that he's talked to her since being thrown into prison. She's beaming. Good news, she says. I finally divorced your stepdad.
She's like super excited and want me to be like super proud of her. And that's what she was looking for, this like confirmation of, man, I did the right thing and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's hard because at that time you're very angry and you're like, fuck you. Why are you trying to come to me for your satisfaction when I was coming to you for that, like, help?
He means help with the abuse. Jeff's mom stuck by Harry even when he got more and more sadistic. One night, he stuck a Tech 9 in Jeff's mouth.
Half of my life has been fucked up because of this guy. You got away from him finally before something really bad happened. Great. Congratulations. I'm happy for you. But I'm not going to be like cheerleading you on because you finally made this happy choice.
Jeff spends the next 5 years hustling. He gets a cell phone and he starts running the flow of contraband in and out of the prison. Drugs, tobacco, alcohol. Until one day, when he gets a phone call.
The counselor asked me to come into his office, and so I went into his office, and he's trying to hand me the telephone. He's like, your aunt's on the phone. I'm like, aunt who? And he's like, your aunt Nancy. And I'm like, I don't have an aunt Nancy. And he says, you'll want to take this call. I'm like, all right. So I say hello on the phone, and instantly when I hear her say hello, I realize who it is. It's my mom's best friend. I can tell in her voice, something's wrong. And she said, she just basically, long story short, she told me that my mom was in the hospital and that she was dying of cancer and that she didn't have very long to live.
The prison releases Jeff on a short furlough. This means he gets to see his mom for the first time in 13 years, and he has a decision to make.
And so I was like, what do I do? You have 1 hour, you know? This 1 hour you're going to be with your mom for the last time, you know? What do I do? Do I hold her accountable for everything? Or do I, like, let it go, forgive her, and give her the best hour? And I was really struggling with that. And as we drove around, I remember the point where I was on the Narrows Bridge. And I just remember looking off and over the water. And
it was clear like it is right now. It was like right in about this section of the bridge when I was just looking out the windows and I was just looking at everything. And I just came to the realization that I wasn't going to hold... I just wasn't going to hold anything against her, you know?
Jeff realizes that his mom has had a really rough life. She's also beat by Harry. She was a foster kid. She had a rough childhood. They've had a lot of the same challenges.
Jeff sits beside his mom and talks with her about fond memories. They look over pictures and he holds her hand. At the end of the hour, he tells her he loves her.
Do you forgive your mom for the mistakes that she made?
My mom could have made a lot of different choices, so forgiving all of that, I mean, I don't know if that's even a thing in this situation. It's just like, it's not really about forgiving. It's just she lived that life and she shouldn't have, but she did. And I'm not holding a grudge against her. If that's forgiveness, if that's the definition of forgiveness, then there you go. I guess it is. But to me, it's just, you know, let it go. So I let it go.
You know, I knew that was the last time that I would see her. But the feeling that I felt leaving there felt good, you know. It was a different feeling that I hadn't felt in a long time, you know. And I thought, man, how can I take this feeling back?
Jeff is 27, and there are 7 years left in his sentence. But he's going to spend these ones differently. He's giving up the hustle to prepare for his release. I'm Gordon Caddick.
And I'm Sam Fenn. You're listening to Cited. Back in 1 minute.
Oh. Cited is made by a team of students, staff, and faculty at the University of British Columbia. But you can help make this program too. Pitch us a story, tell us about your research, or even join the team. You can come to our weekly research meetings and meet your smart new friends, Camille and Eric.
You know, what are the consequences of moving to a petrodollar, essentially?
They would have a promotion where it's like, every time you buy your gas at Chevron, we'll donate more to the school. So then it's actually a bit of a string attached.
And get the radio bug, like Rebecca and Haley.
I don't want to just keep pushing them down, right? Because they're already having, they're already stacked, like the odds are stacked against them. And
if we focus on new things that are changing the system and like in a positive way, then that could be cool. Like, oh, this.
Don't hate the media, be the media. Go to citedpodcast.com to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back to Cited. I'm Sam Fan.
And I'm Gordon Caddick. Today's show is about Jeff Coates. Jeff was 14 when he kidnapped David Grenier.
The story was front page news in Tacoma, and it was part of a national panic around rising juvenile violent crime rates. A political scientist named John DeLillo Jr. predicted that these rates would rise even further. In 1995, he wrote a high-profile magazine article that warned of, quote, the coming of the super predators.
But he turned out to be very wrong. Immediately after DeLillo wrote his article, the juvenile crime rate actually dropped. DeLillo later admitted that he was wrong. But this didn't matter much to Jeff or any of the other 13,000 young people who were transferred to adult prisons in 1994.
When Jeff returned to prison, he vowed to be a new man, and he wrote an apology letter to David.
I really have a lot to say in these next few pages. Before I do, I want to fulfill my first intention with this letter, and that is to say I'm very sorry for my actions that have no doubt caused...
Jeff writes about his whole life, the abuse, the foster care, the crime.
I write you this because it really wasn't until after losing my mom and rereading your letter to the judge that I fully understood what effect my actions had on your whole life.
Jeff tells David that he's read a lot of books and he's taken a lot of classes. He's studying to be a real estate agent when he gets out. He's even attached his report card. It's pretty clear. He wants David to know that he's changed.
In your letter to the judge, you asked where my conscience and morality was, as if I didn't have either at the time.
At 14 years old, with the upbringing I had, it wasn't that I lacked these two traits.
I believe they weren't taught to me properly, and that I didn't truly understand them yet.
I just want to express, Mr. Grenier, that I am truly sorry for my bad choices and actions that day.
My initial reaction was positive, and everyone around me was negative. No one in my family or my circle of friends thought it was true.
Everybody tells David that Jeff is lying, that he just wants to curry favor to get a break on his sentence. David's not sure. He wants to believe him, but he's worried that he's gullible. So he doesn't respond to Jeff's letter.
When Sam first called and talked to me and he referred to him as Jeff, it freaks me out still. I've tried to avoid calling him Jeff because it humanizes that surreal event into that was an actual person. It's sad and good at the same time, you know. Sad at what a waste that is. For those choices, and that he drew the short straw when it came to life and his upbringing, but good that he could overcome that, hopefully.
Just as he doesn't want to ask you for forgiveness because he feels that that would be selfish. Do you think you could ever forgive him?
No, I can accept an apology and accept the things that he's done to try and correct the behavior, but forgiveness isn't important, really. It doesn't really change anything. It's show me, you know, show me what you're doing now that is more important than forgiveness for something that already happened, I think.
It's Boxing Day 2011. Jeff is finally released.
He was 14 when he went to prison. He stayed there for 17 years. Now he's 31.
Somebody told me, man, you gotta stop dressing like you're in the 90s. That's what they told me. So I was like on the phone in the middle of Nordstrom's trying to figure out what clothes should I be buying. They're like, well, first you gotta get out of Nordstrom's because you can't afford Nordstrom's. You need to go to you need to go to Fred Meyer, Kmart.
I saw an ad for a mortgage company for basically a glorified secretary with computer work and stuff, and I was like, everything they're saying on here I can do or I can try to do. And I'm just so nervous, you know. I didn't have a suit. I borrowed a suit from my friend.
The interviewer looks at Jeff's papers and sees 270 college credits, but there's no college listed on the resume. So he asks, where did you go to school?
So I just rolled the dice because I couldn't answer those questions. And I was just like, here's the thing. I have a crazy life story. And I remember the owner, Michael Tutty, he like leaned back in his chair and put his hand on his face. And he's like, I'm listening.
Jeff tells Michael his life story, from foster care to prison to the crime. Think about that for 1 second. He actually tells the story of putting somebody in the trunk of a car during a job interview. And then he pulls out a list. There's 100 books on it. These are all the real estate books that he read while he was in prison. And the list totally works. Michael's impressed, and he gives Jeff a job. At the time, did you think of this as a charitable act, or was this good business?
Oh, it was absolutely good business. I wish I had a whole company full of Jeff Coates types of people, because he is switched on. He is determined that his life is not going to be left up to others. He is going to make it right.
If you meet Jeff today, you'll probably just think he seems like a normal guy. It's hard to tell that he spent 17 years in prison. As we're about to leave, Jeff calls his girlfriend, Gina.
They want to know how you really feel about living with a convicted felon.
How, like,
how do you feel about it?
It doesn't, I don't even think about it. It's not a thing. Like, he's just Jeff.
Gina invites Gordon, Catherine, and I over for dinner. We eat salad and chili in Jeff's cozy house with his dog and his girlfriend. And sitting there, it seems pretty obvious. This is what rehabilitation looks like.
Jeff's not the only one with a rehabilitation story. The most recent data from Washington State shows that 3 years out, over half of the inmates do not reoffend. So why did criminologists get rehabilitation so wrong in 1975?
It was an oversimplification. There were ineffective programs, to be sure, at that time.
Again, this is Catherine Beckett of the University of Washington.
But there were also programs that were showing results, that were significantly reducing recidivism, and they got sort of overlooked in the impulse to generalize.
Back then, social scientists didn't have all the right tools to look over hundreds of papers and make generalizations. That's called a meta-analysis, and those criminologists simply weren't equipped to do it.
Catherine tells us that today's criminologists have identified programs that reduce recidivism substantially. You can go to our bibliography to find a more detailed look at the research. That's citedpodcast.com.
But as early as 1982, there were prominent critics of the Nothing Works consensus. But their work was ignored for decades. And that's a good reminder that the quality of an idea isn't necessarily what determines whether it actually affects change.
those moments where social scientific findings have a huge impact, it's because they're saying what other people already expect them to say, or it fits with somebody's political agenda or something, and they sort of get hijacked and taken and appropriated in some way.
David Grenier is still not sure if rehabilitation works. He says, quote, "I'm not a sociologist, but it seems unproven." We tell him about how Jeff's life has gone since he sent that letter, and that Jeff is still sorry for his crimes.
David writes back to us, "I want to believe everything he's told you and everything he's written to me. However, he still maintains that he did not intend to kill me. This is important, of course, because it strikes to the heart of whether I can believe anything else he's saying. I suppose he's either convinced himself of a lie, or he's still just outright lying. Either way, it makes all the rest harder to believe and trust."
So we call Jeff back, and we grill him for over an hour. We ask him all of David's questions, and some of our own. Like, David says he heard you say, "Hit him with this." What do you say about that?
He's absolutely right. That statement was made, "Just hit him with this." And the reason that statement was made, when they got in the car and they said that they accidentally put tape on his nose.
Jeff says that at a certain point, the plan was completely unraveling. With David flailing around the trunk, they were losing control and they had no idea what to do. So they decided to pick something up in case David jumped out at them. It seems like they were preparing to hit David. But Jeff maintains that there was no plan to kill him. He's adamant about that.
You gonna see eye to eye on everything? I don't think so. I mean, we lived two different parts of that day. Is there anything that I can ever say to change his mind as far as what the plan was? I don't think so, because for the last 20 years, that day went a certain way for him. And it's only not until he got a phone call from you that possibly that the idea that there may have been a different circumstance is now at play.
We're not sure what to believe. Jeff has a plausible explanation for every uncomfortable fact. But when you add up all the uncomfortable facts, it doesn't look good.
The person out of all these conversations that knows 100% what the story was, what was going to happen, through what the plan entailed and where the plan was going is me. In the end of the day, there's no way to prove whether whatever I'm saying is right or wrong. You just got to go based off of, I don't know what you go off of. I would say if someone was analyzing me, I would say go off of my life from what I did inside all the way up to now, then tell me.
Hello.
Hi, David. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Did you get a chance to listen to the recordings?
Yes. You know, I found myself noting inconsistencies in a few of the comments. But rather, you know, as I thought it through, rather than focus on fleshing out an explanation for each and every one of those, I basically decided to believe him, probably because believing him and his assertion that he could never kill an innocent person makes me feel better. You know, who doesn't want to feel like there's one less person in the world capable of murdering someone?
Really? You actually believe him?
I do. Well, I want to. And so I decided to.
Jeff's happy that he's had a chance to make peace with David. David is closer to understanding where Jeff is coming from and closer to accepting that rehabilitation is possible.
As for Jeff's co-defendants, Anthony Pugh is 21 years into a 30-year sentence. Gene Anderson was released, but later convicted of a lesser assault charge in 2007. His record has been cleaned since then.
Today, most prison reformers believe in rehabilitation. And studies show that kids are more likely to be rehabilitated if they stay in the juvenile system. There's been some progress on this. In the last few years, 15 states have made it harder for judges to put kids into adult prisons.
Today, Jeff gives talks around prisons and colleges in Washington. He's even spoken to the state legislature. He says that if there's one thing he wants you to know, it's that people have the power to change. Thanks for listening to our premiere episode of Cited. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/citedpodcast. Or you can send us an email. That's cited.podcast@ubc.ca.
Our program airs each and every Wednesday. You can subscribe by searching Cited Podcast on iTunes. We also broadcast from CITR 101.9 FM and CJSF 90.1 FM.
You can find out more about our program at citedpodcast.com, where we have much more, including our bibliography. We weren't kidding about that tagline. It's actually a blog, though.
We interviewed a lot of really smart people to make this episode. One of those people is Professor Craig Haney, and we're going to put an interview with him up online. We've got a lot of people to thank this episode. Thanks to Jesse Beckett Herbert for the original score. Thanks to Catherine Beckett, Bryce Ellis, and the whole University of Washington team as well.
This side of the border, I want to thank Kamal, Sophie, Rebecca, Cherry, Jane, and the rest of the Cited team, especially Stephen, Vince, and Nav. They helped out a lot on the new website. And a big shout out to Sharon Powa, who designed our spiffy new logo. But most of all, thanks to David and Jeff.
Cited is brought to you by the University of British Columbia and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. For Gordon Caddick, the University of Washington, and the University of British Columbia, I'm Sam Fenn. Thanks for listening.